detecting or doing further probes of a signal of missing pulsars at the galactic center. And I'll also talk about proton annihilation, centavitrons, pivotrons, and the Susie dark matter surface. Because we'll get there. That's just 100 TeV. Sorry, it's not quite as All right. So first of all, I'd just like to make the point that dark matter could soon be discovered in nuclear or electron recoils, nuclear or electron collisions, or electromagnetic oscillations. Dark matter could show up in any of these things.
What are the mean electromagnetic
oscillations? So there, I'm just talking about axions. But in order to fundamentally advance, our understanding of nature's symmetries using that information, we have to determine we have to determine more. We have to know what's stabilizing it, and probably how it was primordially produced. Because in the end, we'd like to find dark matter, but I think most of us would like to get some guidance on where on the symmetry continuum we should begin expanding. Because some people like to add gauge groups, and there's reason to believe perhaps we need to do that to stabilize dark matter. Some people like adding additional gauge representations. And a lot of Susie stuff falls into that category. And also, you need Poincaré reps or additional symmetries of space-time for other models. But mostly, we'd like to know where exactly we're going. And sort of in that vein, I'd like to motivate the fact that, I'll get there. So the hardest task, once we find some dark matter interactions, will be to figure out what interactions dark matter has with other particles. So there are many possible handles on that. People have talked about, looking at bullet clusters colliding with other bullet clusters gives you a handle on dark matter self-interactions. You can infer the velocity from the velocity dispersion. You can infer what dark matter self-interactions there are. Modulo problems with multi-body simulations. And looking at the different shapes of different halos, you can also figure some stuff out about dark matter self-interactions. But one particular symmetry that you can think about is the symmetry present in asymmetric dark matter models. Because in asymmetric dark matter models, we suppose that dark matter in the halo, like ordinary matter in the halo, is composed of particles and not antiparticles charged under a continuous symmetry. And this asymmetric abundance precludes chi-chi as opposed to chi-star chi annihilations. So I guess one of my major points is that in a very futuristic setting, the interactions C and CP violating that lead to a dark asymmetry might be revealed through something like a pulse collider plus Kamioka program. But even there, you should be skeptical. I mean, when people talk about actually figuring out that we have asymmetric dark matter, keep in mind we haven't even measured the dark sector we have very carefully yet. I mean, we don't have the CP violating phase of the neutrinos. We don't even have their mass scale yet. So to think that you're going to fully characterize the dark sector as soon as you find it is a bit unrealistic. Of course, we'd like to find it first, but given all that, in this talk, I'll show that on a much shorter time scale, old pulsars in the galactic center imploding into black holes could be a signal of asymmetric dark matter. And this signal is very robust in that it relies only on the fact that annihilating dark matter with even incredibly tiny annihilations cannot copiously collect in pulsars to form black holes. First, I'm going to go over some very, very basic physics. Just for fun. What? Yes. Well, in the end, we're just modeling everything as spherical balls, unfortunately. Everything of this talk is essentially just spherical balls. So to start out, just consider parametrically dropping all factors, what the number density is for fermions. Well, are we doing bosons first? Oh, we're doing fermions. For fermions in a neutron star. And it's basically this. Keep in mind that your number density wouldn't have to look like this if you didn't have Pauli exclusion. Pauli exclusion tells you that in any given volume, you can only have two for spin 1/2. But in this case, we're just saying one fermion and dropping all factors. Yeah, give me a sec. Yes. All right.
So, I mean, what is n here? Does it not total the number of fermions you have?
Fermion number density, total number of fermions, radius of your ball. Okay. Given that number density, you know, your interfermion distance, so the distance from one fermion to the next is just going to be r over n to the third. Right. So if I just ask, given the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and this, what the momentum should be related to this, then the momentum of a fermion is just n to the third over r, right? Okay. So when we put up the Chandrasekhar bound, or the maximum number of fermions you can have in an enclosed ball r, all you're doing is you're balancing the energy of the fermions, and you're saying the energy of the fermions is and this is in the ultra relativistic limit. What's that? Oh. So just setting this equal to zero and solving for n is exactly how you get the Chandrasekhar bound. The r's cancel. That's it. So my point here is just you can make very, very simple arguments and figure out why exactly you're getting neutron stars collapsing at the galactic center. So this is the first simple argument we need. The next argument we need is to compare that bound with the bound on bosons. In this case, we don't have the Pauli exclusion principle. And so our number density just goes as 1 over r cubed. And we just get this. And that's why we have mass Planck squared over m chi squared versus mass Planck cubed over m chi cubed. Now, if you know the mass of...
When you say the number density is still n over r cubed, right? It's just that...
Right. It's just that you're not stabilized by Fermi pressure in that case. So
yeah.
In that case, the relationship between momentum and the sort of characteristic boson-boson distance just goes as 1 over r.
Okay. So
yeah.
The momentum, you're saying. The momentum.
Yeah. Yeah.
The number is...
In the ultra-relativistic limit, yeah, the number density is still the same. However, in the fermion case, you can't have multiple fermions in the same space, and so it gives you a different interfermion distance.
So you're assuming that the bosons are non-condensed
ones? Yeah, I'm assuming that in the limit that they're about to collapse, that they formed a BEC, yeah. Okay. Of course, these collapse bounds you can think about in terms of visible or dark matter, although we don't have any visible example of a stable boson. At a fundamental level. The next thing you need to know is just that a pulsar is a spinning neutron star observed as a regularly radiating revolving magnetic dipole. So that's what a pulsar is. As non-astrophysicists, we're not necessarily aware of that, but it's really just a sphere with a magnetic charge in one direction. The direction of the dipole isn't necessarily exactly aligned with the spin, and that's what a pulsar is. And then, just based on the fact that you have a spinning magnetic dipole, you can figure out how old a pulsar is. I can give you the very heuristic argument. If you want, I can do the full argument, but the heuristic argument is far more fun. Okay, so we have the pulsar, and it's spinning around, and it's pulsing. And every time it pulses, it's giving off a certain amount of energy, and so its pulse rate is slowing down by a factor of p dot for every pulse. But then over time, we add up those slowdowns of the pulse rate, and we keep adding those up until eventually p, the pulse rate, has been set by all those little diminutions of the pulse rate at each pulse time. But then if I just take all those diminutions that add up to the entire pulse rate and then divide it by one diminution, then that should give me the age of the pulsar. That's the simplest argument you can give for how you know how old a pulsar is. It's p over p dot. When you actually do it correctly, it's got a factor of 2 in there, and this is assuming that you're only losing energy to the pulsing of radiation off of the dipole. Right. Now, we know how old pulsars are, and that either Heisenberg or fermion pressure stabilizes compact matter, and that's really all we need to discuss pulsar-destroying black holes formed from dark matter collected in pulsars, along with a few other things, which I'll get to.
Isn't there some anomaly in the pulsar,
Sure, yeah, they're tiny anomalies, but in terms of an order of magnitude, we can tell whether a pulsar is roughly 10 to the 9 years old or 10 to the 7 years old, which is all that's really required for what I'm going to talk about. Yeah, there are lots of little fine details about pulse rates that I don't know that are argued about for good reason. Okay, so for our purposes, we only need to know that the capture rate in a star roughly goes as the dark matter density divided by the velocity of dispersion, and that it scales with the cross-section of dark matter on the star. There's tons more in there, which I can go to if you guys would like. So that's the first requirement in order to destroy a neutron star, is that it's captured. You have to capture some dark matter. The next requirement is that it thermalizes, or that it rescatters enough that it forms a ball at the center. So the most precise calculation of this was done actually last year by Bertoni, Nelson, and Reddy. And they actually calculated, using different ansatzes for what the neutron fluid actually is, how long it would take to thermalize. And they used that actually to lift some bounds on asymmetric dark matter in certain cases of neutron fluid equations of state. Next, the dark matter collapses to a black hole, which happens if you've collected enough and thermalized enough. Bosonic dark matter forms a BEC first, and at this point we'll talk a little bit about modifications to these two equations. A ball fermion says Fermi degeneracy pressure. So is there any possible way to change that? Yeah. If you just add a simple Yukawa interaction that's attractive. So for fermions, you can just couple it to a scalar and you automatically have attractive self-interactions. The number that you need to create a black hole can be less than M Planck cubed over M chi cubed. If you have that term in your Lagrangian, you can get an attractive force. So yeah, if I just add a Yukawa term, I can change how many. The mass of phi definitely enters, and depending on what your mass of phi is, you will or won't get a collapse or a resonant enhancement to collapse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. The quantum wavelength has to be larger than the interparticle separation.
Yeah, and that's it.
Not really. There's actually two limits. So you're talking about the unscreened or the long wavelength limit, but actually in the totally strongly screened limit where you still have the exponential suppression and you haven't gotten over that to a more Coulombic like potential, you can still have collapse. There's some phase space there.
How can the quantum wavelength be much shorter than the interparticle separation and matter less?
So when you say the Compton wavelength is much less than the interparticle distance, you're saying that M phi has to be small enough that this prefactor is less than 1. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I know that there's phase space where that's not true, and you still get collapse initiated as a result of adding this in. And that's true for very massive dark matter particles. So we can look at that and maybe think about why that's different. All right, so a ball of thermalized bosons will be repulsively stabilized by even a very tiny quarter coupling. So if we add in lambda phi to the fourth term, which in this can just rescale the mass, then that will mean that we require more bosons before we can collapse into a black hole. So very basic principles tell us whether or not, you know, dark matter is going to collapse, and we can fiddle with our model parameters to get into phase spaces where we collapse as fermions or don't collapse as bosons when we would have naively expected to. Then the black hole accretes, radiates, and if it grows rapidly, then you can bound asymmetric dark matter. If you don't form a black hole that's massive enough, then it's going to shrink, and it's not going to accrete faster than it's radiating, and so you don't get a bound. All right. All right, so these are bounds that I came up with on asymmetric dark matter. This is not original in the sense that there were other papers that had bounded bosonic asymmetric dark matter. What we looked at in particular was how the introduction of very tiny self-annihilation terms lift the bounds. And it turns out that for self-annihilations much, much smaller than a picobarn, you can basically throw out the bounds entirely. That tells you that you have to be that the dark matter in the halo has to be incredibly asymmetric, or it's you're not going to have a bound. Yeah.
So how does the symmetric? I mean, this is probably a very stupid question. Mm. So you have a lot of height to the fourth direction for the boson.
Yeah.
If it's a symmetric, if it's a symmetric, it means it has a charge. So that term is interaction between two of baryon number one and two of baryon number minus. So how does is the quartic interaction active if you have a preserved space?
Two particles coming in, two particles going out.
Are you asking about the relation?
You're right. No, it's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
It's fine. Don't worry.
Oh, this is for the boson having its own self interactions if there's just one. Yeah. Okay, I see. Okay. Yeah, I thought you were asking a deeper question, which is how. Well, the better question to ask is that red
different,
bound.
A different question to ask.
A differently motivated question to ask. I don't know. Whatever. Is this red curve over here assumes lambda is zero. It doesn't change where the curve is as long as you assume that it's less than 10 to the minus 30. But of course, that's a bit of a strange assumption, given that we know the dark matter has some sort of scattering with fermions in order to get into the star to begin with. And so, immediately I can, close this loop. And then, what have I done? How do I actually enforce that lambda equals exactly zero? And, actually, do we even care about these bounds at all? Because, this purple bound comes about if I have a lambda of 10 to the minus 15. And, just based on some very simple arguments for the coupling of dark matter to neutrons, I'd expect this to give me a lambda of 10 to the minus 15, unless I supersymmetrize the whole interaction and I somehow.
What if I have a shift symmetry?
For phi? Yeah, I'm not sure if the shift symmetry would prevent you from having it. You're just saying that if I...
It's basically then the interaction of the scalar with the normal matter is mass suppressed.
Okay, then that would be small too. So you require more than...
But I'm getting confused about what is the big picture that you're trying to tell us
on the
slide.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's just go to the end of the slide. And okay. So these are bounds on bosonic asymmetric dark matter. Assuming I have a cross section given on this left hand side and a mass given on this bottom portion. Okay. I can lift that bound with incredibly tiny self annihilation interactions. So if I just look at the red curve, for 10 to the minus 42 centimeters cubed per second, which is like 10 to the minus 15 picobarns, the bounds already lifted up to 10 to the minus 48 or so. And so actually for around 10 to the minus 36, this goes away entirely. And you just have no bounds on any bosonic asymmetric dark matter parameter space. So if, unless your halo is truly asymmetric under some symmetry, you're never going to get these bounds. The more troubling thing is perhaps that I don't know that a boson shift symmetry actually gets rid of this problem. But yeah, you're assuming very, very tiny quartic self-interactions for your bosons, because if you don't, then your BC is going to be stabilized more than you expect it to be if you just had purely non-interacting bosons, and so you're not going to collapse as quickly. As you ramp up your self-interaction cross-section, the reason you bound higher masses, and the reason you don't bound lower masses is just because you don't collapse anymore. But the reason you bound higher masses is because the right edge of these curves is set by the balance between Hawking radiation and accretion of the neutrons into the black hole. And so requiring that you have more bosons around to collapse at higher masses gives you a higher mass black hole, which allows you to tip that balance so that you're not radiating as much and you're collecting more.
And the different for sigma beast interaction with matter?
That's the boson self-annihilation cross-section.
So are you getting the right health abundance for these things with the consistent assumptions about what the annihilation?
Not at all. This is just at the level of assuming contact interactions for the bosons against nucleons and just looking at their masses and then looking at their couplings to themselves and their self-annihilations. That's it.
But this is a chi-chi annihilation process.
This is a chi-chi annihilation.
Chi-chi. So the chi-chi bar is much larger.
Oh.
Yeah, sure, because it's asymmetric, yeah. Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah, and I should plug this actually. So that's a bit of a strange thing because I've told you the dark matter is asymmetric, and yet I'm having it self-annihilate, right? But if it's charged under two continuous symmetries and it's asymmetric under one of those symmetries, so it develops an asymmetry under one of those symmetries, but it's not the lightest charged particle you can possibly have, then you can have it annihilate down to a lighter charged particle.
So this is the particle-particle annihilation, not the particle-particle.
Right, so this is particle-particle annihilation, and you know, one example in the standard model is a proton hitting a proton and turning into two positrons, which is allowed as long as B plus L is. For the very low dark matter, what do you guys? Evaporation off of the actual neutron star, you're saying. So I collect and the actual radius that it's collected into is too small. Right. So that kicks in substantially when you're below a keV, so I'm just above where that's a problem. Right. Right, the escape velocity for a neutron star is 0.7 the speed of light.
Right.
So the bound for where you start evaporating is much lower.
And what is the temperature?
The temperature is 10 to the 6 Kelvin, but that doesn't really help you figure out what.
Yes. No.
Yeah.
So 10 to the 6 Kelvin, that's like.
That's 9 EV, so.
At 100 EV or so?
9.
9 EV, okay. No. Kelvin is 10 to the minus 4.
Is it? Okay.
So, anyway, it's 100 degrees, okay. So you're saying, evaporation is not an issue.
Right. All right. So, I consider fermionic asymmetric dark matter.
So, what is the take home message? So, in the original, there was some original paper by Kachev and company on this.
And you mean? Kachev or who?
Kachev. TKA. There was some.
CHEV, yeah. It's from this 80s.
No, a long very. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But what I'm trying to ask is what is the
No, I think, sorry, you'll have to show me this paper, because so Kuvaris and Tennikov had one paper on this, Zurich, Tulin, and Haibo, you had another paper.
Yeah, so that paper by Zurich and company, I think, was fairly wrong. It was a paper by the...
Well, it was initially wrong, and then they added in the actual BEC dynamics,
right,
and then it was correct again.
Yeah. Than,
oh, well, it was Chris Kuvaris and Peter Tennikov.
Oh,
so,
Tennikov, sorry, yes, that's right, Peter Tennikov and Chris Kuvaris, yes.
Yeah.
No, they didn't consider the self-annihilation and
no.
But so, what is the general picture I should take from this?
The general picture I would take from this, and actually this was more outlined in a follow-up paper by Nicole Bell, Calliope Petrachi, and another author who I'm forgetting. It was a grad student. Is that you shouldn't believe these bounds on bosonic asymmetric dark matter.
Because for
any realistic quartic coupling, and you'd really have to supersymmetrize away that quartic coupling, you're basically not going to have a bound because for like a 10 to the minus 10. Right, you could.
I mean, this makes assumptions about what the underlying model is, as always, right?
That's okay, but let's discuss this after. But at least the statement is clear. It's saying that for realistic models where there is no protection of lambda, this is not a bound.
No.
Okay. We can figure it out later.
All right. You guys are pretty familiar with this, so I'll breeze through it really quickly. So you can have resonant self interacting fermionic dark matter. There are some nice models by Tulin, Yu, and Zurich. Other people have done work on this as well. And the general picture is just that the characteristic momentum that you get in a dwarf halo for a certain parameter space and Sommerfeld-like enhancements of the interaction by just balancing the mass of the dark matter at 50 kilometers per second and the mass of the dark matter at 220 kilometers per second for, you know, a given phi mediator mass, you can have very large self-scattering cross-sections in dwarf galaxies and not so large in bullet clusters in Milky Way galaxies. So that's what motivates the sort of area of parameter space that has a small bosonic dark matter mediator. It also, in some parts of the same parameter space, you can have this be your mechanism for freezing out psi and psi bar as long as phi is light enough and alpha is large enough. But it turns out you can bound this self-interacting dark matter using the same sort of considerations. This is work I did again with Kumar, Fukushima, and Stopnitsky. Over a fairly appreciable range of the parameter space, you can actually bound what parameters you can have. So the mass of phi here is 10 MeV, 5 MeV, and 1 MeV, and sort of for in the strong coupling regime, you can land into a parameter space that fits the core cusp problem, but that is bounded by neutron stars. All right, now I'll invert the logic a little bit and turn this bound into a kind of a detection regime. So that's the fun part. So prior to the detection of a very luminous magnetar 1/10 of a parsec away from the supermassive black hole at the galactic center, it was assumed that pulsars had not been detected there because a charged screen of material at the galactic center was broadening pulse signals. I can go over pulse broadening if you want, but the basic idea is there's a dispersion measure that depends on the electron density from you to whatever object you're receiving radiation from, and that's just because of Compton scattering as the radiation comes to you. So you'll get different scattering at different wavelengths. What was thought is that we weren't seeing millisecond pulsars and younger pulsars in the galactic center because there was just too much charged material between us and them. So the radio pulses were just being broadened to a point that we couldn't see them. However, measurements of radio pulses from the newly discovered galactic center magnetar indicate a much cleaner path for radio pulses than was supposed. In addition, measurements of the radio pulses' angular broadening match those of SGA star, so this is the very bright star we have that's orbiting the black hole that we infer the black hole's mass from. And the fact that these two broadenings match each other seems to indicate that the scattering screen or the electrons are homogeneous. So you could say, okay, well, you saw one pulsar, but the other pulsars are just in areas where you have a lot more you have a lot more in the way of charged material between you and those pulsars, but it seems from looking at other sources and their pulse broadening that the screen of charged material is basically the same. So this creates two missing pulsar problems because both young and old millisecond pulsars seem to be absent. Depending on how you do the numbers, there are between 50 and 500 missing millisecond pulsars. So that's kind of interesting. This is a little bit of a confusing plot. This is from the DEX. Out of 2,000 expected, roughly.
Wait, so 2,000 are expected
we should have seen roughly a fourth to a half, essentially above this red line, where the blue line is just, where the blue dots are just already seen millisecond pulsars. But sorry, to get to your question, should I think of that as a lot? Maybe they're doing more surveys at increased adding.
Well, let's ask it this way.
Yeah.
Let's not talk about the total number.
Yeah.
In that region, not near Sagittarius A.
Yeah.
How many were expected and how many are observed?
The number expected was between 200 and 2,000. The number observed so far is zero. Right, and just based on some simple arguments about the luminosity of pulsars we've already seen as a function of their pulse periods, and the dispersion measure that we now actually have for the galactic center, we should have seen somewhere between a third and a half of them.
Can you actually explain this plot? Can you ask a little more?
Yes. Sure.
It's clear you don't want me to just say.
All right. So these are all pulsars that we've seen so far in our galaxy. So these are their pulse periods. So these are the really old pulsars. And it's a little bit counterintuitive. These are the really old pulsars. These are younger pulsars. Right. No, now I'm just confusing myself. Yeah. The reason it's a little bit counterintuitive that quickly pulsing pulsars are older is that usually if you have a millisecond pulsar, what's assumed is that you have another pulsar that's fed it so that it's spun up to a very high rate, and now it's spinning down, so it's actually spinning very fast. So you can do this p divided by p dot calculation, and you'll get that pulsar is actually the oldest pulsar, whereas the younger ones that haven't been fed by another star nearby have a slower pulse rate. So these are just pulsars that have been seen so far. The dashed red curve and the dashed black curve were estimates for what we should have seen based on measurements of dispersion and some basic assumptions. And the solid red and solid black curve are what you'd assume now that we've actually seen a pulsar at the center and actually gotten a dispersion measure. So the idea is just that you should have seen more than you thought you'd already seen. That's what Dexter and Olier are going into.
So the blue are seen as the distribution of pulsars that are seen, but not necessarily near black center. Because the pulsars are seen everywhere.
These are
black and red lines are regions where you would have expected to see a pulsar if there was one in that region.
Right. So for higher luminosity, you'd expect to see them, right? And for a slower pulse rate, it's easier to see them because the pulse broadening isn't as much of a problem.
And where does the expectation come from for the total number of pulsars that you get?
That comes from two things. First, you just look at how many high-mass progenitors there are in the galactic center. You also look for X-ray binaries. Both of these, everywhere else that we've seen pulsars, we've seen fixed populations of those stars just because X-ray binaries are formed from the same sort of star systems that form millisecond pulsars, and large mass progenitors are the things that are supposed to form millisecond pulsars.
So, large mass, you mean stars?
10 to 20 mass stars. Okay.
So the 200 to 2,000 is the number from those estimates, basically a total blue points that you would expect to have total pulsars in there, and then 50 to 500 is the subset of those that you would have expected to be in that quadrant.
Yes. Okay. So, you know, the next question is, can we turn this bound kind of into a detection regime? And could asymmetric dark matter have imploded, you know, the missing pulsars? So remember that the capture rate scales as density over velocity dispersion. So we should actually get, for fixed parameters, more younger pulsars imploding at the galactic center than away from the galactic center. So you can just model our galaxy's dark matter profile using disk and galactic center star velocity measurements, or at least that's what we did in our paper. This is with Tim Linden. I think that was up somewhere. And you get parameter space, and this is for bosons. We'll get to fermions in a second, where constraints from old stars near the solar position put a bound on this parameter space, but the sort of old millisecond pulsars, so 10 to the 7-year-old pulsars at the galactic center, define this line. And so your asymmetric dark matter, if it's doing this, should lie somewhere between these two curves in mass versus cross-section.
So it means that what we're saying is that capture of dark matter in millisecond pulsars becomes slightly easier if they're close to the galactic center for some distributions, and then they just eat them up?
Yep. Yeah, basically. It's just that the capture rate goes up as the density goes up and as the velocity distribution goes down. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
I'm just confused conceptually about something. So if the missing number of pulsars in the galactic center is something that we could attribute to asymmetric dark matter, supposedly,
yeah,
then why would we expect that number? Why would we expect a different ratio of pulsars to some of their progenitors in other places? In other words, the expectation is based on the fact that the ratio of observed pulsars and progenitors is different here than it is elsewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we take that deficit here and say, aha, that's due to asymmetric dark matter destroying some of them, then why wouldn't it be destroying it in other places?
Right. It's just because, you know, your capture rate for the neutron star, right? It's proportional to density divided by velocity dispersion.
So it's a statement about...
It's a statement about the density in the center of the galaxy versus the density here.
Okay. So the scatter plot that we saw was based on other parts of the galaxy or on other galaxies?
So we've only seen pulsars in our galaxy.
Okay.
So, and all these pulsars are outside of the galactic center.
Okay.
But you would expect suppression. So there's a window where all pulsars get killed really quickly?
Yeah.
There should be a window where you don't see any old pulsars, but you do see young pulsars, right?
Out near us, yeah. So we'd have to be below...
We'd
have to be between the really old pulsars we've seen out by us, 10 to the 9 years old, actually, and being able to collapse sort of 10 to the 7.
Yeah, no, so that's the range. And I'm just saying, then there is, for example, then if you go, say, twice as far out from where there's some nearest pulsars that we've seen.
Sure. So you're saying we could have been collapsing, you know, younger pulsars near us.
No, so let's say we live in that blue band.
Yeah.
Region. So that's saying that's consistent with the existence of old pulsars near us.
Yeah.
And it's consistent with eating up all the pulsars in the sort of very inner portion of the galaxy.
Right.
Now go out a little further from the center of the galaxy.
Yeah.
And still close.
Yeah. This is the we get to watch scenario.
Okay.
So the one pulsar we've seen is this old. So if we watch it explode, then maybe you think that dark matter lies exactly on this line. Yeah.
Okay, but what if you go out further?
What if it's like, so ten, it's really a linear scaling, so it'll be like 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8. So year-old pulsars at the galactic center. But am I missing some part of your question?
I think so. Or maybe my question is deeper than I realize.
No.
As you go out from the galactic center,
yeah.
If you were to plot a scatter plot of how far a pulsar is from the galactic center,
yeah,
and how old it is,
I'll do that in
okay.
Three slides, and then okay. So I talked down bosons before, and right now I'm doing model building just for fermions because to actually impose symmetries that do kill this and really kill it. which is something I was trying for a little while, it's not so trivial. You really sort of need to supersymmetrize the whole system, although I will talk to Mina later about this shift symmetry idea, because I'm not sure about that. That could be cool. The fermionic case is perhaps much better motivated in the same phase space. We've already been talking about both to annihilate away the symmetric component at early times and because it fits the Corvus cusp problem. And dark matter fermion parameter space can actually fit into this regime where you're collapsing pulsars at the galactic center and not by us. So, so now you should predict from this a characteristic maximum pulsar age as a function of distance from the galactic center, just based on whatever profile for dark matter you're assuming, along with velocity dispersion. I think maybe this is what you were looking for, that you should get maximum pulsar age curves as a function of distance from the galactic center. And then you'd want to take these age curves and, you know, plot where all the pulsars are. So all the pulsars we've seen are sort of on this plot, although there are more farther out that I didn't include. These are all bosonic dark matter curves. The fermionic case is a bit more complicated because you have large self-interactions, so that's something I'm working on right now. So you want to model the halo profile correctly for your strongly interacting fermionic dark matter that's also collapsing pulsars and be consistent with what you think the densities at the center and by us. Right. This is the one pulsar we've seen at the galactic center and its location. Recently, as in December, some astrophysicists cooked up a paper where they used this mechanism to explain what FRBs are. So FRBs, if you're unfamiliar, are fast radio bursts, and no one knows where they're from, but apparently if all neutron stars at galactic centers surrounding us are imploding, the rates, according to this paper, fit as an explanation of FRBs. Neutron stars actually, a neutron star spinning very quickly and then collapsing had already been proposed as a source for FRBs. There are problems with their treatment of this, because this is actually an idea I was playing with some other people, and I can talk about that offline, but I have a lot more to get through. So conclusions, part one, there is an exciting method to distinguish asymmetric from Majorana or mixed dark matter. Pulsar age distributions could also be applied to bounds-on and searches for multi-component dark matter. Because if you have one of these weird disk scenarios and your disk is asymmetric, all of a sudden you have a prediction about what should be happening to pulsars along that disk, depending on what your parameters are. So that's another thing you could do with it. Okay. To understand asymmetric dark matter that self-annihilates, you're often making these analogies of protons annihilating to positrons. So that's something I just got interested in with my advisor, and then we did it. So let's just start with a simple exercise. So begin with a U1B cross UNL cross UNB minus L universe. So gauge baryon number, lepton number, and baryon minus lepton number, and then break it to discrete symmetries and see what nucleons do. So if you preserve UNB minus L, break B plus L mod Z2, then you can have just protons decaying to electrons plus something else. If you preserve U1 but break baryon number, then you can have protons decaying to pions plus something else. If you break Z baryon number mod Z2, but preserve lepton number, then you can have NN bar oscillations. So this is very well studied in the context of a number of models. And lastly, if you preserve UNB minus L completely, but break B plus L each by a factor of 2, then you can have protons annihilating to leptons. And so that's what proton annihilation is. So there's you can make very simplified models for this. I'll move a bit quickly, and I'll just point out that this is, you know, one case where you'd get lepto quarks. If you just assume a four vertex of scalars and some additional scalar that couples to them that actually carries baryon and lepton charge, that's sort of the minimal model content you need to create this. Okay, but what's cool about this? Well, what's cool about this is the lowest dimension operator you can write down that breaks baryon and lepton number mod 2 is dimension 12. And so it's suppressed by a factor of m q to the eighth. And so when we think about bounds on baryon and lepton number, we think about super K and we think about large Cherenkov tanks. And there's a reason for that. It's because they actually achieve the highest luminosity. They're not winning on energy. They really are winning on luminosity. Because the characteristic scale of that interaction is between 200 MeV and a GeV. And so what's going on is that they just have a lot more luminosity, and that's how you're constraining nucleon-nucleon interactions and other interactions. So just by simple scaling, just by simple dimensional analysis, you can figure out what number of signal events you should get at these experiments. So you have the square of your operator, your cross section gives you 1/e², and then you have your luminosity, and that gives you your number of events. But notice that your number of events goes down by a factor of cutoff to the inverse cutoff to the 16th, and so with energy, you win by a factor of energy to the 14th as you increase in energy. With luminosity, you're only increasing linearly the number of events. And so, you know, there must be some tipping point for high dimension processes where energy wins out over luminosity, right? So actually, here are the current bounds you can place on proton annihilation or B plus L mod 4 violation. And at super K, it's roughly around never mind this, it doesn't even matter. For super K, protons and oxygen nuclei annihilating to electrons, you get a bound that could be set of roughly 1.6 TeV. At the LHC, a calculation we did shows that you can get a bound at around 800 GeV. But it turns out that we're about at the point where we're going to tip over, and your best access to B plus L violation is actually going to start coming from hadron colliders. So at the 14 TeV run of the LHC, if you get 3 inverse adabarns, although that's not really necessary, as we see, luminosity doesn't really matter. So actually, within the first few hundred inverse femtobarns, you'll achieve parity with super K. Or you'll just find these processes because super K actually hasn't actually done the study yet. So, yeah.
A specific models, I guess this is, you're just doing the operator analysis, but 800 GeV is pretty low energy, even for current LHC.
Yeah, absolutely. So right. So the bounds there are just often going to be from, you know, well, for the model I showed, it's going to be digets, and you'd have already seen it up to like, you know, 3 to 4 TeV easily for that mediator. It's a perfectly valid point. But you know, in the most pessimistic scenario, or just as a function of your cutoff, you are actually beginning to win at hadron colliders. And then, of course, at 100 TeV collider, you'd essentially surpass these high luminosity machines completely and probably into perpetuity, because you'd have to increase the luminosity of your experiments by a factor of energy to the, or luminosity to the 14 to catch up, and that's not going to happen.
Should tell the Chinese.
This is kind of the point. That is not coincidental, I will say. I might have been thinking about that. And you can just watch how this works as a function of time. There's this old collaboration, Frages, that no one ever talks about. They actually did do the only experimental search for proton annihilation to dileptons. I think Super K will maybe look into it now, but we'll see. So this is just a consequence of the scaling relation. What about the next tipping point? Where would the next tipping point be where you'd be able to get access to dimension 9 operators, where you're just violating baryon number mod 2 and making 2 mesons? And the answer there is you'd need a pevitron. So this is how large of a collider you'd need to make a pevitron with 16 Tesla magnets. There are some, you know, good features here. First of all, you're going through Washington, D.C., so you can just lobby Congress directly and or threaten to divert the beam. And then it goes through Ohio, so neither political party can dismantle it without, you know, risking the next election cycle or the next few election cycles. So these are some advantages here. Of course, we can just expand this and, you know, run it through Toronto.
Water.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah. Yeah, CFF, I think like half or more of you have been here, so don't worry about that. All right, so the next conclusion is that a high-energy collider program could be a necessity in order to further probe primordial lepto and baryon dark matter asymmetries, contrary to prior experience. So we may actually be hitting a point where just making a larger water tank doesn't actually bias much for certain processes, definitely for baryon plus lepton number mod 2, so for B plus L violated mod 4 and B minus L conserved, but this will continue into the future, actually, which is interesting. Okay, so last set of slides. Now I'm just going to talk about neutralinos because I have pretty pictures. So consider a supersymmetric spectrum with all scalar particles and the gluino decoupled. The result is a low-scale spectrum with Beano, Higgsinos, and Winos. So these are just the singlet, doublet, triplet reps of SU2. Now require that these particles freeze out to the correct relic abundance only through coupling to standard model states. So this is well tempering except in the case of pure states. You get something that looks like this in three dimensions, which is pretty fun to look at. So here we're just looking at over the sort of relic neutralino surface. This is essentially the parameter space where you're freezing out to the correct relic abundance without Sommerfeld enhancements added in or loop corrections to the mass splittings. But so it's essentially all at tree level. But you can start to see some interesting things that are going on.
The Sommerfeld effect is a fully calculable effect.
Yeah, so we're working on that in a follow-up paper. But yeah, so that'll kick in, you know, above roughly. That'll affect, first of all, where this Wino surface of relic neutralinos is. And then it'll also affect slightly what happens above 1.6 TeV on the Beano-Wino surface once you can produce Ws on shell in the thermal bath. So what's interesting is that, you know, over these exact wings of Beano-Wino relic neutralinos where you have incredibly low spin-independent scattering. And here's a three-dimensional surface. Go to the website afterwards. Okay. Over those same surfaces, actually, you have fairly tiny mass splittings. And that's because you're creating the right balance to give you the right relic density. So this is the Chargino neutralino splitting, and we shouldn't believe it down to a GV level because this is not calculated at loop level correctly yet. But you can already see that on the Beano-Wino surface, just as an effect of having the Higgsino state around, you don't have a small enough splitting to see particles in charge tracks. What you do have is an incredibly large branching to the LSP plus a photon from the NLSP. And what that means is that this makes you fairly, this makes the relic neutralino surface itself, and specifically the Beano and Wino wings, really amenable to compressed photon and lepton searches at a very large energy hadron collider. So the sorts of signal regions you'd be looking for, the signal would be composed of a photon plus dileptron pair from a chargino decaying to a neutralino through emission of an optional W to dileptrons, and then a radiated decay to the LSP and a photon. Whereas the background would be from W's and photons. And kind of the really interesting takeaway here is that you win as opposed to the standard model, because in order to produce a large amount of missing energy in the standard model, you're going to need to, you know, have very boosted W's. But to have very boosted W's, you're going to have very boosted leptons. And that means that if you do a search for high MET and low lepton PT, you're going to do much better at a larger energy collider. And so the red here is signal, and the black is background. And at 100 TeV, there's a much greater separation between the signal leptons and the background leptons in low PT bins. And this lets you do kind of crazy things that you wouldn't necessarily think about, which is one of them is finding BNOWINOs that are essentially split by just one GV, and there's some other assumptions that go into whether or not you can actually see those, but that's interesting in itself. So these are BNOWINO mass splittings and the luminosity needed for 5-sigma detection, and with 10 inverse Atabarns, you could actually find BNOWINOs that were only split by roughly one GV. No, this I'm just showing off that you can see down to very small mass splittings to visualize how much of the BNOWINO relic surface you can get. It's essentially that much. And that's within 10 verse Atabarns with some reasonable assumptions about 100.
Are there numbers that you have when you want
to? These numbers are just giving you the mass splittings between the BNO-like lightest state and the WINO NLSP state. Yeah. In GeV. The cuts that I used changed from there onward, which is why it slopes down all of a sudden. It's not incredibly optimized, but it shows in principle what you can do.
And the colors, match the
glow that you have? This shows you essentially what's accessible, given this result. We can talk offline since you're interested in this. There's some interesting notes about what happens actually once you get above that. You can actually still find it through indirect methods up there. It's kind of fun. And so just finally a little add-on. The relic neutralino or split Suzy surface can be discovered with 100 TeV compressed dark matter collider searches. So that's it for my talk. Thank you. Yeah. Okay.
So
we can.
So to step back for a moment, if you were to argue that the alleged pulsar deficit in the galactic center is really just a function of how poorly we observe pulsars or how we resolve them
with
individual point sources, and you assume that those pulsars are actually there, exactly the number that we expect, then would you, with those numbers, resolve the galactic center excess with millisecond pulsars?
You're trying to link. Sorry, can you say this again?
The argument, as I understand it, is that there's currently some puzzle about observed versus expected pulsars in the galactic center.
Yeah.
You're arguing, or there is a claim in the literature that
Is
a deficit,
yeah.
Right?
I wrote this paper with Tin Linden. He writes papers about pulsars mostly to say that they can't cause the GeV gamma ray excess, right?
Right, and I'm saying that, if you just assume, if you just take the numbers at naive face value, you say, all right, there are really a lot more pulsars than think, it's just that they're hard to see for some stupid reason, then does assuming that the deficit doesn't exist give you enough pulsars to resolve the GC excess also?
No. So the assumptions they use about number of pulsars in the galactic center is the exact same assumption we use for, this would just kill more pulsars. On the other hand, it would give you asymmetric dark matter, so it wouldn't necessarily be annihilating to photons anymore in the simplest model.
No. I'm saying, forget dark matter.
Okay.
In those estimates of Linden and company,
yeah,
about what is the contribution from millisecond pulsars,
right?
What do they assume about the amount of millisecond pulsars in the center of the galaxy?
They assume the same things that these other studies assume when they find them, when they talk about the missing pulsar problem.
They assume what is observed, or they assume what should be observed?
They assume what should be observed. Well, not even what should be observed. They assume what everyone infers is there from the population of high mass stars and X-ray binaries, which is around 500 to 2,000 millisecond pulsars.
Okay, so they're not constraining themselves by only the ones that have currently been observed.
No, that would be ridiculous, right? Because
zero
have been observed.
Okay,
so yeah.
Just wanted to clarify.
Yeah, I mean the whole yeah.
Yeah.
The whole point of those guys using those blotting things is that they have these templates where they take any like large sources of 1GV and they just blot that out and don't count it. And they're assuming those are, you know, the pulsars. And then, you know, the arguments in their papers are all about how, you know, the pulsars couldn't cause 1GV to diffuse spherically throughout the entire galactic center. But that's kind of a separate argument from this guy. Yeah.
Where the plot that you show, you had another plot that had purple pulsars on it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it looks like the deficit appears at 1 kiloparsec. It's not like it's just in the galactic center.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so it's not... I mean, you should see some stuff also in between, right?
Well, okay. Millisecond pulsars are the easiest to resolve because they have very fast pulses.
Yeah.
And so the dispersion isn't as much of a problem. And so, you know, maybe we should start seeing them out here, right? And maybe someone's model building right now where you have fermionic asymmetric dark matter, which has a semi-chord central profile because it follows the baryonic density at the center of the galaxy, and this gives you a fairly flat density distribution. So, I mean, what I'm saying is, with a fermionic model, I think you can actually make it look like it actually
like
does.
That.
Yeah.
What about gamma? Does it include the gamma ray pulses that they see from Fermi and stuff like that? Because I thought they discovered many more pulses from Fermi.
I think they discovered a lot of pulsars, but none at the galactic center with Fermi.
Ah.
So for the bosonic dark matter, I won't go all the way back, but the self-interactions do the reverse thing that they do for fermionic. So for fermionic self-interactions, which I made attractive by coupling the fermions to a scalar, right? So I made these attractive self-interactions. So those actually allow the fermions to overcome the degeneracy pressure and collapse when they shouldn't if they were just free fermions without self-interactions. Whereas with the bosons, you know, you can't have an attractive self-interaction without some severe problems with your model and the universe.
But it's a bit of a cheat because
yeah.
you could have just coupled. So for the fermion, I could have said, well, but if you couple them to a gauge boson, then they're actually repulsive and attractive. Mm-hmm. And for the scalar, I could have said, well,
flip
but
the
if
sign.
You allow, no, you cannot flip the sign. But you have to add something else. But
you have to add something else, but then at a fundamental level that breaks down, so you need that something else to stay there up and through Planck energies, because as it collapses, it's going to reach Planck energies. So I didn't even get into this, but you actually also have to verify that once the particles become relativistic, because this collapse calculation happens in the non-relativistic.
No, just let me add the same thing you add for the fermions. I'll add the scalar that interacts with your boson.
Okay.
That will add the attractive interaction.
Yeah, okay.
Just cubic.
Sure. Yeah, you could add.
I'm just saying you're allowing yourself to sing with the fermion that you don't allow yourself with the boson. You're totally discriminating against the bosons here.
The hub of masses.
You make a fair point. So your point is I should think about setups where, you know, I have a self-interaction for the boson, but I have an additional boson that gives me an attractive interaction that cancels that out.
Because you allow us to have that freedom for the fermion, so.
That's fair.
Thank you.